I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
I'm Michael Polignano.
Welcome back to another Countercurrents Radio weekly show. Today, we are going to talk about the upcoming Unite the Right gathering. We're going to talk about John's recent visit to Romania and the Transylvania Saxon gathering that he attended. And we're going to talk a bit about the Google diversity memo and its consequences. And after that, we'll have a little bit of shop talk, mostly focusing on upcoming events that Countercurrents is sponsoring. So before we get into that, though, I just want to run through some of our donations from the past week, and I want to thank people for sending in money. So first of all, we received $100 from John, $10 from Chris, $10 from Gudrun, $1,000 from Lee, $10 from Mark, $20 from William, $100 from James, $10 from Matthew, $100 from Gabriel, $100 from another James, $200 from David, $5 from Joel, $10 from Christian, $20 from James, $10 from Victor, and $10 from Ken. So thank you, gentlemen. Gentlemen, and I think there's one lady in there as well. Yes, definitely Gudrun is a lady's name. So ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your support. It really means a lot.
Yeah, thanks from all of us, really.
All right, so let's talk about Unite the Right. I just want to say I like the idea of this. I support this. I would be there if it were possible. I have obligations that I can't break away from, basically. So I won't be there, but I'll be there in spirit. That said, I am a little worried about this event. I thought the first event in Charlottesville was great. And the optics of it were excellent, the torchlight stuff, the fact that people had a uniformed kind of dress code and so forth. All of that was excellent. I thought it worked really, really well, though, because it basically followed the formula that a lot of identitarian events in Europe have, which is it was not publicized widely in advance. It was gathered together, well coordinated, and it was photographed and entered into the permanent record of the universe, right? And a lot of these really successful identitarian ops basically boil down to quick photo opportunities that are sprung on the world as a surprise so that the enemy does not have a chance to organize to counter it. And in this case, though, the Charlottesville thing has been given months of buildup. The enemy has been organizing to oppose it. They've been doing all kinds of skullduggery. It's all very, very instructive as to the soft totalitarian nature of the system we live in today and the utter loathsomeness of the people who oppose us. That's all great agitprop material. So thank you, guys. Thank you for showing us your true colors. But it also means that chances are that the event might not happen, or it might not happen as planned. And specifically, it might go down as a bloodbath, frankly, as a fiasco. There are large numbers of Antifa coming, large numbers of counter-protesters, and now the call has gone out to the nationalists who are attending to bring arms. So I'm hoping that Unite the Right doesn't turn out to be the Altamont of the alt-right. And by the Altamont of the alt-right, I refer to the famous Altamont concert that the Rolling Stones gave in the late 60s, where some of their security people, somebody had the bright idea of hiring Hell's Angels to do security, and they murdered somebody. And that, along with the Manson family Tate-LaBianca murders, was trumpeted around as basically a line under the 60s counterculture. People said, stick a fork in it, we're done, we're through with this. I just hope that Unite the Right doesn't turn out to be the Altamont of the alt-right. What do you guys think?
I definitely support the idea of it. I agree with you, though, that the potential for it turning into something ugly is pretty high, although I've got to believe that some of the organizers, you know, that's what they're hoping for. You know, it seems like there are certain people who think that by challenging the left in this way, they're actually, you know, making a public stand that people will be drawn to them because of that. And I sort of understand the logic, but my problem there is that it's mistaking who the real enemy is. I mean, you know, the Antifa and all these other anti-racist action groups and everything. I mean, they're basically foot soldiers for forces that are much larger and more deeply hidden than they are. So I feel like in some ways it kind of mistakes who the enemy really is. I mean, we still have to remember that even though there's somebody at least sort of sympathetic to us in Washington now, that basically still the American system is rigged against us in every possible way, just about. The other thing that worries me about the event is that I feel like by being open to everybody, it sounds really great to unite all the forces of the right, but the thing is, I mean, I always thought that the purpose of the alt-right, well, two of its purposes was, first was to distance itself from mainstream conservatism in the U.S., or cuckservatism, as we call it now, but also, of course, to distance ourselves from what Kerry Bolton has amusingly called the retarded right before. And among that, what he means are people who like to dress up in Nazi uniforms and, you know, want to LARP about it being the 1930s all over again and this sort of thing. And I just, while there are definitely many people who are going to be at this thing who I respect, I feel like they are letting in some people who are going to kind of taint the thing, because it's going to enable the mainstream media to show sort of the denizens of the alt-right in lockstep and linking arms with people who really, I don't think, are on the same wavelength that we are, and only will confuse the public about what we want. I mean, it just reinforces this notion that we're just neo-Nazis and Klansmen and so forth. So I don't want to sound like I'm entirely negative on this event. I mean, I think it's great that something real world is being done. I just feel that the potential for misunderstanding, not in the minds of people who already support us, but in the minds of people who either are on the fence or, you know, don't know what to think about us yet, is high in this situation.
Right. I think that's a very good point. In a way, the point you're making, I believe, boils down to a point about optics and a point about engaging the public, putting out an image for the public. The first event in Charlottesville was optically very successful, basically because the people who organized it controlled the optics and controlled its dissemination. There wasn't any enemy press there and so forth. Whereas this event is going to have the enemy press involved. They are going to be searching out people that undermine our narrative and support theirs. And there are going to be people involved in this thing who are bad optics, to put it mildly. And those are the ones who are going to be allowed, as far as the general public is concerned, to define the whole thing. They're going to be the poison pill, basically, that is going to be put out there. And so, yes, I do think that that is a problem. And it does boil down to, again, the very conception of the event. The success of the identitarian movement in Europe has been not just to have real-world events, but to have real-world events where they can control the optics of them and disseminate their image, their chosen image, and their chosen message, and then get through provocation the mainstream media to take it up. And that's what happened with the first Charlottesville event. It was textbook identitarian agitprop, I thought, and very successful because of that. I didn't even know the thing was happening. I am sort of out of touch about a lot of stuff because I'm no longer on the East Coast and so forth, but it came as a complete surprise, and it was a pleasant surprise. The other thing, I guess, to think about here is that uniting the right basically is an attempt to patch over the split that happened between the so-called alt-light and the alt-right after Hailgate back in November.
Right.
However, I don't see any sign of the desire to polarize those two camps going away on the part of people like Andrew Anglin and Richard Spencer. Anglin was really the leader in this thing, as far as I can remember. He was the one who was pushing for this. And then Spencer got on board, and since then Spencer's been tweeting nasty shit about people like Milo and Cernovich and so forth, and really trying to stir that pot up because he thinks obviously that's going to benefit his alt-right.com. He's now controlling the brand again. And I don't know, you know, will the real Richard Spencer please stand up? Is it the Richard Spencer who's polarizing everything relentlessly? Or is it the Richard Spencer who's one of the headliners of Unite the Right? You know, so I honestly don't know how well thought out this whole thing is, to be honest, and whether the unifying impetus of it is coming from the same people who are working in other ways to polarize everything. Perhaps not. The people that I understand are the main organizers of the event are Jason Kessler and Eli Mosley. So Mosley is a Spencer orbiter, basically. I don't know about Kessler. I met him just briefly at Ameren, but I didn't get a chance to talk. There are just too many people circulating around, and I could never just find him alone when I was alone and have a conversation. So I just don't know. So anyway, I'm a little just confused about it. I do think people like Augustus Invictus clearly have a big tent agenda, and he's part of the event. I don't think he's one of the main organizers of it, but he's definitely part of it. So I guess these are just more questions about what the dynamics are here, where this Unite the Right impetus is coming from, and so forth.
Yeah, it's interesting because you do have all these different individuals and groups on the right. On one level, it's a motley crew kind of tied together. But the aim of all this is to congeal behind a common force. For too long, the right has just put forward arguments. And I think there's an awakening going on. People are realizing that you have to have more than just arguments. You can convince a minority of people just through reason, logos. But in persuading people, you also have ethos and pathos. Ethos is a matter of convincing people through your status and how successful you've been in the past. Pathos is a matter of convincing people through emotion and support. And I think since the event at Berkeley, that was the first time that people on the right really kind of held their ground and exhibited strength as a group against the left. And I think that the larger masses of people, you have to convince through ethos and pathos. You're not going to be able to reach them all just through reason and logic, but rather through strength and who is there and going to actually hold the ground. And this will be a test of that this weekend. I hope it doesn't devolve into violence. I don't see it getting out of hand. I think that the police in Virginia are a lot less likely to accept a stand down order than the police in California, Berkeley especially. And I see it being an orderly event. You know, granted, there are going to be lines and attempts to break through the police, but I don't think the police are going to let things get disorderly the way they did in Berkeley. I think as well, another thing to come out of this is a lot of people saw what Airbnb tried to do as far as canceling the bookings.
That was interesting, yeah.
They tried to cancel the book, not only cancel the bookings, but also deactivate the accounts of people who were reserving rooms and bookings for this weekend in Charlottesville. So that's out there in the public now, and everybody can see that. So, yeah, I hope it all goes down well.
Well, just to clarify what I was saying before, too, you know, I don't have any problem with the fact that these groups, some of the more, shall we say, problematic ones that I mentioned, that they exist. I mean, I think it's good that they're there because they can say things that others can't. But certainly going back to the new right in Europe and my understanding of what we've been trying to do with the alt-right in recent years is to get beyond all that. So I just feel like to make it seem like, you know, we have a united front, we were only going to be judged by the lowest common denominator, not by the highest common denominator of the people who were there. So I hope it works out anyway. And, you know, like I said, I'm glad there's something real world happening. But I do see a lot of potential from this understanding. But we'll just have to see, I guess.
Yeah, I do think what happened with Airbnb is truly shocking and extremely useful for us because, well, it's just so flagrant. It's just so obvious. This company is engaged in political activism, basically. They are taking sides in a political event.
Did they actually cancel the accounts of people who tried to?
Yes.
I hadn't actually heard that part of it.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're basically saying, oh, if you support this, then you're not even welcome to do business with us, is basically what they're saying.
Yes.
Yeah, they are saying that it goes against their terms of service.
Which is bullshit, really. I mean, that's obviously not true. Well, in a way it's true, though, because the terms of service just basically mean that political correctness rules. So it maybe not be the written terms of service, but certainly the spirit of the whole thing is being violated by these people. And so, yeah, they're cracking down. They're shutting it down.
I have to wonder, too, how much of that is based on a thought-out, reasoned decision at the top, and how much of it is just kind of this culture that everybody has accepted subliminally. I mean, you have this totalitarianism of the left that we see in the case of the Google employee that was fired recently because of his memo, which we'll be talking about in a little bit. But I don't want to get too far off topic, but I'm thinking about the Patreon canceling Lauren Southern's account. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that story or not.
Yeah, right. I heard that it happened.
Yeah.
I think it happened to several other people involved with this identitarian Defend Europe campaign on the Mediterranean, right?
Yes, yes. Well, the CEO, after that happened, he actually kind of backtracked a little bit, which, you know, a lot of people have given him credit for. And I give him credit for as well, for actually coming and discussing the thing. And it was pointed out that there is this leftist Antifa group. I forget the name of them. Something like It's Going Down. It's Going Down is the name of the group. And they basically try to dox people and try to basically shut people up and threaten people, either physically or through doxing. And they actually, after it was brought to the attention of the Patreon CEO, they had their Patreon account closed as well. So, yeah.
Well, I know I'm not the first person to say this, but, I mean, we are living in a different world since November. And, you know, it was sort of a wake-up call to globalists, to liberals, you know, to everybody who dislikes what we stand for. And I feel like they now feel like they have to break their own rules, you know, in order to sort of suppress us. And, you know, we really don't know how far it's going to go. A friend of mine just a couple of days ago sent me an article from the World Socialist website, which talks about how they've been doing research into how Google filters search results on its search engine. And they were able to figure out that there was this algorithm that was blocking 150 search terms that were preventing people from, I guess if you still type in World Socialist website, it comes up, but there are other search terms that you use that would ordinarily bring you to content on their website that no longer appears when you do a search. And, you know, the reason my friend sent it to me, and he's right, is he said, you know, if they're doing this to radical left-wing groups, what do you think they're doing to radical right-wing
exactly
websites?
And you know, I have gotten way behind in our newsletters because I've just been so busy. But I think it was at the beginning of April, as if by an invisible hand, suddenly our traffic went down considerably. And I think it has to do with monkeying with search engines. I think that's the most plausible reason for that.
This World Socialist website article mentions April 2017.
Okay.
That's the point when this started for their site.
Okay, well, that's very interesting. I think that's important. I do need to come up with an updated newsletter just so people can see the top 20 articles for the past few months. But yeah, I asked Peter Brimlow and Jared Taylor if they had seen downturns around the beginning of April in their traffic. They didn't recall seeing such downturns. They said that they had a big downturn basically after the election was over. Now, that didn't happen with Countercurrents. In fact, after the election, we continued to grow. And it really kept growing until the beginning of April. And then things changed. So I honestly think that they're blocking people from getting to us. And of course they are. Of course they are. And we'll remember that because someday our people are going to be in the position to call the shots in private companies and in the government as a whole. And we will remember their commitment to the principle of free speech, their quote-unquote commitment to free speech.
Right.
They are being more open about it as far as the Google YouTube videos are concerned. I think they made an announcement just within the past week that videos that deal with controversial subjects and are flagged as such will no longer be recommended videos to other Google users based on their interests.
Right. Honestly, it's time to really push this idea of regulating Google, Twitter, Amazon.com, and all these other companies as public utilities. They have to be regulated as public utilities. We have to force them to respect the First Amendment. I think that should be something that everybody pushes who's right of center. Everybody who's right of center needs to push this. And honestly, the far left, if they're being interfered with as well, they need to push this as well. This is the true horseshoe effect, right? The extremes united against the center to regulate private businesses as public utilities, because that's really what they are. These are natural monopolies. Amazon.com is now the book market. It is the global book market for all practical purposes. And if they can say, well, we're not going to take your books anymore, then we're screwed. That's just the end, basically, for Countercurrents and any other dissident publisher. And we have to be prepared for that eventuality. And we really, really should support in every possible way this kind of regulatory agenda. I think it would be tremendously freeing. Basically, this should also be the case with public accommodations. If hotels cannot discriminate against you on the basis of race, they should not be able to discriminate against you on the basis of your ideology as well. Basically, the whole country and all private enterprises within the country need to be forced to respect the First Amendment, not just state and federal governments.
I agree with you, Greg. I think that's a great idea. You know, we should support that. You know, I can't help but think, though, that that's only a temporary stopgap, because, I mean, for now, even in the current climate, the government's still doing a good job of protecting the rule of law when it comes to, you know, even protecting our ideas and our ability to communicate them. But it seems to me that if they really start to feel that they're being threatened, you know, that there really could be a real paradigm shift, that, you know, they'll find a way around it somehow. They'll pass a new constitutional amendment or something.
Already, things are looking more and more banana republic-like in America. The calls from the left to just negate the last election, basically this attempt to, let's just say what it is, it's a left-wing coup against the Trump administration. That's what's being called for.
Left-wing slash globalist.
Globalist, yeah. Far globalist coup. That's what's going on. And frankly, I think Trump needs to just fire the special prosecutor. He just needs to gut it out, fire the special prosecutor, and then he needs to appoint special prosecutors to start investigating the enemy. And that means the Democratic Party, the Clinton machine, and let's just name the foreign power that really interferes with American elections. It's not Russia, it's Israel. Let's have a special prosecutor looking into Israel ties. That'll shut them up really fast. Of course, Trump might not cross that line. Might not.
I don't think so.
There's no way. Yeah.
But no, seriously, he needs to go on the offensive. Otherwise, they are going to basically have some kind of trumped up, hate to use that word, trumped up impeachment thing against him. And this special prosecutor has broad fishing powers. He's already gone off the topics that he's been hired to investigate. He's just fishing around for a pretext for a left-wing globalist coup against Trump. Trump needs to shut it down. But yeah, if that does happen, though, that is going to be the point when it's no longer any pretense and America is just a banana republic. It's just a colony of global capital. Just like the banana republics are, for that matter. Their democracies don't matter, and apparently neither does ours.
It's petty and insane, this witch hunt that's going on after Trump right now. But I will say that the left got it right as far as their defense of net neutrality, which is something that prevents internet service providers from charging tiered levels of service, and basically allows free access to whatever content that you're seeking, regardless of who it's owned by. So, you know, you don't always see the left and the right cleave on clear sides all the time, but definitely having some regulation, regulating Google and YouTube as utilities, Facebook, you know, all these social media is very important because it's part of how we communicate in today's day and age. And I think ultimately, beyond just uniting the right, I think we're also going to unite real people from both the left and the right, ultimately, who are concerned about local communities, just about restoring common sense and are against this kleptocracy that's dominated things for a long time in America.
One thing I'd like to throw out there, and this is connected with deplatforming and censorship connected with YouTube, is, again, I want somebody to put me in touch with PewDiePie. He's got 56 plus million followers on YouTube. They are demonetizing him. They are limiting his ability to make money from this. If he were to take his 56 million plus followers and migrate to a new censorship-free platform, that would be a sufficient number of people to make it instantly successful. And I want to put him in a room with a billionaire who would fund something like this in a heartbeat if it could actually be started, if it could actually get going. So if anybody out there is in touch with PewDiePie and wants to get in touch with me, I need to meet this guy or at least talk to him, because he really could do something revolutionary. He could, as his legacy, create a censorship-free YouTube platform, and that would be probably the biggest media coup for our side ever, because, like I said before a thousand times, we don't have billions of dollars in capital to create a new television industry or anything like that. But if we have a single platform that is global, where everybody comes, and that is censorship-free, and also allows us to monetize things, there will be a thousand cottage industries of people popping up with monetized YouTube channels to get our message out. We just need that medium, a censorship-free, monetizable video platform. And he could be the guy who forks off from YouTube and makes that successful. So I want to talk to PewDiePie. If you're listening out there, folks, put us in touch.
There has to be a certain critical mass of people who switch, or it's not going to work.
Exactly.
You know, I think with the Twitter users switching over to Gab AI, I don't know how successful that's going to be. Because, yeah, sure, there can be a communication that continues, but it's just going to be kind of a continued echo chamber among people who are already on the right.
And that's why these things are natural monopolies and should be treated as such, like utility companies. It is not easy to start a rival, because it just makes more sense to stay with the old tried and true one. That said, remember the MySpace generation? That's no more. They're gone, and Facebook is king. In 5 years, Facebook might be gone, and something entirely new might be king. It is possible, and I would love to see YouTube fail. I would love to see YouTube and Google fail. Fail big time. Because they are forces of evil in this world. They are the corporate power that we should all be fighting, okay?
Right. But they're not homogeneous. I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of people who sympathize with the alt-right and with countercurrents even, who work within these companies.
I know there are.
Keep it to themselves, yeah.
I know there are. One of them just got fired, and we'll come back to that. But John, let's segue into your discussion of your visit to the Transylvania Saxons this past weekend. I'd really love to hear about that.
Yeah, sure. And I'll probably end up writing an article about this too and provide a little more detail on that. But, well, for those who don't know, the Transylvania Saxons, the name is kind of a misnomer, because while some of them probably came from Saxony in Germany, most of them did not. It was actually a legal term that was developed by the Hungarian crown in the 12th century to describe this group of people that had settled in Transylvania at the invitation of the Hungarian crown. This is when Transylvania was still part of Hungary. They mostly came from Germany, but there were also some who came from France and Belgium and Holland and one or two other places in Europe. But the majority were German, and certainly the culture of the Transylvania Saxons is a German culture. There's no question about that. And I myself, my mother is 100% Transylvania Saxon. Her parents, well, actually her father was born in Transylvania. Her mother was born in the U.S., although her parents had been recent immigrants. So I'm half Transylvania Saxon myself, and I've always been very interested in this topic, naturally, since it's my heritage. And I was fortunate in that a few years ago, my relatives who were actually born in Transylvania, they emigrated to Germany in the 1980s as part of a secret program between West Germany and the Romanian government. That I won't go into it now because it's too complicated. I wrote an article for it at Write-On, which I think is still up at altright.com. But I'll go into all this when I write an article for Countercurrents. But anyway, my relatives live in Germany now, but they still like to go back to Transylvania quite often. And a cousin of mine, my cousin Georg Riel, has been kind enough to show me around the places where my family is from in the Saxon part of Transylvania. But because there was this mass exodus of all of the Transylvania Saxons, both during the communist period in Romania and then immediately afterwards in the early 1990s, in the 1930s, they peaked at about 800,000, the population. And then nowadays, it's said to be about 10,000. So that there's really very few left in Transylvania itself. And in fact, during the communist period in Romania between 1945 and 1990, there was a systematic oppression of the Germans, also of the ethnic Hungarians in Transylvania. And there were actually no mass gatherings of a traditional nature for the Saxons that were allowed after 1945, as one of the outcomes of the Second World War. So this event I went to last weekend was actually the first event of its kind in Transylvania in over 70 years. So it was quite a historic event in that sense. They estimated that about 15,000 Saxons, mainly from Germany and Austria, also a few from the U.S. and other places, such as myself, were in attendance. It lasted for 2 days, and there's still a series of events happening, smaller events happening in other parts of Transylvania over the course of this week. I think into next week as well. The event that I attended was in Hermannstadt, which is the Saxon name for the city. The Romanian name for it is Sibiu, and it was sort of the capital city of the Saxons during their time there. And a lot of my own family was from that area. So they decided to have the event in this city. And it was really something, I have to say. I'd been to a couple of smaller gatherings in Germany before of Saxons, and that was very enjoyable and informative for me. But this, just the sheer number of people was quite impressive. I mean, we basically took over the city for the weekend. But it was really nice. And we were also addressed by Klaus Johannes, who is the current president of Romania, and he's actually a Transylvania Saxon, which I think is probably one of the reasons why this event occurred in the first place, since it helps when the president is one of your people. There were also some politicians from the CSU party in Bavaria who are Transylvania Saxons. I forget his first name, but his name is Fabricius. He was in attendance and even wore the traditional Saxon ethnic outfits to the event. But just to sort of briefly describe it, they had a series of cultural and musical events. You could get traditional Saxon food. They had lots of traditional Saxon music playing, both the more popular forms, and there also were some performances of Saxon classical music. Like, for example, his name is slipping my mind at the moment. I'll definitely include it in my article. But Chopin actually had a prodigy who he took under his wing, who was a Saxon. And he was considered sort of the heir apparent of Chopin. But he unfortunately died unexpectedly when he was 17. But as it was, he left behind a significant body of work that survived. So some of his works are performed, as well as a few of other Saxon composers. And one of the highlights for me was they had a big parade where all the people who were present who were wearing traditional Saxon dress for the occasion had a parade in a ring around Hermannstadt. And I participated in that because my cousins who were there were kind enough to loan me some of the clothes for the occasion. And that was a lot of fun. It really, you know, as an American, you know, it's very easy to, I mean, even though we all know we come from Europe, it's still something a little bit foreign to us just because, you know, while our roots are there, let's face it, I mean, America is a unique entity. But this, it really helped me to feel my ancestry is something real. You know, when you had all these thousands of people around you, interestingly enough, who are kind of in the same position as me. I mean, even though they grew up being exposed to this Saxon culture, since almost all of them now live in other countries, you know, they're sort of fighting to keep their traditions alive, which I'll get into this in my article. But I mean, I think it's something, a kind of identitarianism that I think all Europeans around the world should be thinking about, because 100 years ago, the Saxons were basically the aristocracy of Transylvania. And in a very short period of time, because of some political misfortunes that befell them, and also some mistakes that they made, some bad decisions they made, they basically lost everything, became an oppressed class within Transylvania. And now they're not there at all anymore. So it just goes to show that just because you're on top of things at one time, you can lose that very quickly. So in a sense, even though obviously the processes that are affecting the entire West these days are very different, you know, it just goes to show that these transformations can occur quite quickly. But I'm happy to say that the Saxons are definitely doing their bit to fight for their identity and to preserve something of it. And I did not see a hint of political correctness the entire weekend. It was very definitely a politically incorrect event of a very traditional German nature that you probably wouldn't even see very often in Germany these days.
I looked at some of the videos you posted on your Facebook page. They definitely weren't very diverse.
No, strangely enough, there was one black woman I saw during the parade in the traditional dress. And all I can think is that some Saxon in Germany must have gotten with an immigrant. Uh-huh. I don't otherwise know. I never met her. I just saw, because there were 2,000 people in the parade. I spotted her at one point. But other than that, I saw nary a trace of any sign of liberalism or political correctness. So I can't help but feel very proud of that, that I come from a people that still wants to stand for something and, you know, isn't interested in just homogenizing into the modern world.
Yeah, I think I read on your Facebook page, isn't the motto of the Transylvanian people, "We want to remain who we are," or something
yes.
like that? Yeah.
Yes, that's true, actually.
That's great. And I think every people should be as wise.
Yeah. I hope they're able to maintain it, because, you know, in speaking to my cousins about this, they're all about my age or slightly older. And they were telling me, you know, it's very difficult to get the young people who were born in Germany interested, because, you know, they think of themselves more as Germans than as Saxons.
How many people turned out?
I heard 15,000.
Okay.
And there were quite a lot of young people. So I can't believe that it's the case that everybody is losing interest.
What's the population of the town where everyone met?
Oh, well, of course, now it's almost all Romanians. But I would have to look that up. But my guess would be a couple of 100,000. It's a fairly small city. It's not on the scale of Budapest or anything like that. Although I did read that in the 16th century, Hermannstadt was considered to be the equal of Vienna.
Wow.
So, of course, Vienna was a lot smaller than
that. A lot smaller, right?
But still, I think it was regarded culturally and otherwise as an equal. But yeah, so that was quite an experience. And I posted some photos and videos, like Mike mentioned, on my Facebook page, but I'm also going to write up something about it for the site. So,
is there a big ring that goes around the city center, like there is in
Yes, Vienna? It's just called the Großer Ring, the Great Ring, and that is sort of the center of the old part of town. There's a new part of town which, you know, like most places in Eastern Europe, you know, is filled with these horrible, you know, kind of communist era block apartment buildings. But the good thing is that in the two world wars, there was never any fighting in Hermannstadt itself. Plenty of Saxons fought in both world wars. In fact, I had relatives who fought in the Wehrmacht and the Waffen-SS and the Romanian army during World War II, but there wasn't any fighting in Hermannstadt itself, so it was largely preserved, the old city. So it still looks pretty much, you know, the way it has for centuries. And it's the style of it is very similar to Vienna, the style of the architecture.
Is it still called Hermannstadt by the Romanians, or do they have a completely different name for it?
Sibiu is the Romanian name, and the Hungarian name is Nagyszeben. Because, you know, Transylvania traditionally has always been, you know, the three major groups were the Hungarians, the Romanians, and the Saxons. Of course, there were Gypsies and Jews as well, but they were, you know, those were the three major groups. And when Romania got Transylvania from Hungary at the end of the First World War as part of the Treaty of Trianon, they set about systematically renaming everything into Romanian names. But they've, since 1990, they've kind of realized what has been lost, you know, the Romanians. So now on a lot of the signs, it'll say Sibiu/Hermannstadt. So sort of trying to, you know, maintain something of that legacy. And I didn't get the feeling at all when I was there that there's any hostility from ordinary Romanians towards Saxons. I mean, a lot of the people in the city came out to watch when we had the parade, or even participated in the events. And, you know, my cousins who grew up in Transylvania have Romanian friends, and they came and had a beer with us in the evening. And so, you know, I, as usual, I mean, I think it was more the fault of communism and of the political system than of the Romanian people. So, you know, I don't get the impression of there being any animosity between Saxons and Romanians today. Although, of course, as they say, absence makes the heart grow fonder.
Right.
So it might be a different story if they were still living there. Because when I told some of my Hungarian friends that Klaus Johannes was going to be there, they said to me, well, you know, you should ask him, why won't he grant autonomy to the Seklers, those are the Hungarians in Transylvania. And because they're still having problems with Romania even today.
Well, there's like 1.2 million Hungarians in Romania. It's a pretty substantial population.
Yeah, it's huge. But they're still, you know, the Romanians are still, you know, trying to... Yeah, I don't think that they're being treated as poorly as they were under communism. But, you know, I think that they still feel like there's sort of a cultural war against them.
Mm-hmm.
I've certainly heard this from Seklers who I've met here in Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm sure the feelings aren't as harsh as they are between the Germans, Poles, and Czechs regarding the namings of cities historically.
Oh. Well, I think it was like that, but I think that they've, you know, like I said, they've kind of been relaxing that over the last quarter century. But you know, the reason why this was the first traditional Saxon gathering, you know, of this nature in over 70 years is that under communism they were forbidden. You know, my cousins were all born in Transylvania. They didn't leave until the 1980s. And they said, you could wear traditional dress at a private wedding or something. But the idea of, you know, having thousands of Saxons in traditional dress, you know, with music parading in the streets, you know, that never happened under communism. That was very much frowned upon.
So is there any move to move back from Germany to Transylvania on the part of some of the ethnic Saxons? Things I assume are somewhat economically better in Romania now. Is there any attempt to repatriate?
No, not really. I mean, a few of them, I know of cases, not any in my family, but I've heard of cases of a few Saxons moving back, but it's very small because, I mean, the reason they left was that not just for the Saxons, but everybody in Romania under communism were horrible. You know, just yesterday I was talking to some of my cousins about their childhoods, and they told me that, you know, you would go into a grocery store and literally the shelves would be empty, or maybe they would have potatoes or something like that. But they said if you didn't grow your own food, which they all did, you would starve. That was a very real possibility under communism. So when they got to Germany and, you know, sort of got, you know, sort of Western style professional jobs, they became far wealthier than they ever could have in Transylvania, even when things were good. So I think that you know, will prevent many of them from wanting to go back, just because, you know, they like living in Germany.
Right.
They don't really feel like it's an alien land.
Of course.
They have the same culture, but I mean, they also do feel like something is being lost.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, even if they move back now, there's so few left, you know, you wouldn't really have the support mechanism to sort of get, I mean, maybe something will happen. I did meet one gentleman who actually wants to reestablish a Saxon village, and even had a DVD that he was giving people with a demonstration about how it would work. Mm-hmm. And he wants it to be, well, I mean, it wouldn't legally be an all Saxon village, but it would be intended mainly for Saxons and function according to all of the traditional ways. And I wished him well. I hope he's able to do it. But he was telling me he thinks it's going to be a hard struggle. But apparently there are some people interested.
That's interesting. It might be the case that, for instance, retirees, people like that, whose incomes become limited, might find it attractive to live there because the basic cost of living in a place like Romania is so much lower than Germany.
Yeah, well, there was this film called Trading Germans. It was a documentary about this secret program between West Germany and Romania, where the German government was actually paying to get Saxons out of Transylvania, to get them to Germany during the communist period. And there was one Saxon farmer who had moved back, and he said, you know, I tried living in Germany for a while, and then I moved to Canada for a while. And he said, I just found that materialistic way of life so empty. So, you know, he moved back to Transylvania, and he's a farmer again. And he said, you know, there's so many untapped resources in Transylvania. He said, you know, it could become, you know, an agricultural powerhouse. He said, you know, people just need to, you know, sort of tap into it. And he said, so, you know, for me, he actually says in this movie, the future of Europe for me is in Transylvania. It's not in the West.
That's fascinating. You know, the Saxons came to Transylvania in the 12th century, was it? They were colonized there by the King of Hungary. And it's conceivable that maybe they'll come back to cultivate that land and build cities again. It's possible.
Do the Transylvanians still have their unique dialect of German, or has it been kind of subsumed into a broader Bavarian?
My cousins who are born there all speak Saxon. I asked my cousin Georg, who's a few years older than me. He has two daughters who are in their 20s. So I asked him, well, do your daughters speak Saxon? He said, yeah, they do. But he said they don't really like to, because he said when they speak it around, you know, Germany, Germans, you know, I guess it sounds kind of like this, or, you know, it sounds kind of backwoodsy, or, you know, kind of hickish or something
provincial,
like that.
So, yeah.
Yeah, provincial. That's right. That's a better word. So, you know, they do know it, but it's not in common usage anymore, except among the older generations, I get the feeling.
That's interesting. Well, we've been going for more than an hour, so let's segue, I think, just to the shop talk segment, and maybe we can do stuff about Google next time, and we'll certainly learn more about the fallout of this particular memo and firing in a week's time. In terms of shop talk, I just want to mention three events that Countercurrents is sponsoring. One is in the Bay Area on Saturday, the 19th of this month, the 19th of August. It's the 8th Francis Parker Yockey Memorial Dinner. We started doing this in 2010, and we did it every summer, basically to commemorate the death of Francis Parker Yockey in the San Francisco jail on the 16th of June, 1960. And we started it on the 50th anniversary. Michael O'Meara gave a speech about Yockey on that occasion. And we've had smaller and larger versions of that dinner ever since. So that is going to be happening. If you want to get an invitation, please contact me at editor@counter-currents.com. Second event is the following Saturday, the 26th of August. It'll be in the greater Puget Sound area. It's the Northwest Forum, and we're having four speakers, including myself, Augustus Invictus, and our headliner is Jared Taylor. Also, Margot Metroland, who's well-known to Countercurrents readers, is going to be the mistress of ceremonies. She'll be introducing people. I think we'll break 100 people at this event. The ticket price is $40. Please contact me if you want an invitation. Again, it's a private invitation-only event. Who's there and what's said is off the record, although some of the speeches might be taped and put online later. But, of course, Q&A stuff will be cut out. Anything that would identify people there will be cut out. Finally, on Monday, the 18th of September, in Seattle, Countercurrents is going to be sponsoring the Francis Parker Yaki 100th anniversary, 100th birthday dinner. We're doing two Yaki things in quick succession. The 18th of September is the 100th birthday of Francis Parker Yaki. He was certainly one of America's greatest contributions to our larger cause. And we're going to be celebrating it by having a dinner. I will give a slide presentation with a bunch of photos that have never been published of Yaki, and also photos related to Yaki. I and a couple of friends have been doing a lot of archival searching to find more pictures, so eventually there'll be more pictures than just Yaki in handcuffs, which is the one that everyone sees. So I'll be doing a slide presentation. I hope we'll be also launching the new Yaki anthology edited by Carrie Bolton called The World in Flames, which contains all of Yaki's shorter writings, which means that the only other Yaki writings that will be out there will be Imperium and The Enemy of Europe. I also want to announce that Countercurrents is going to do new editions of Imperium and The Enemy of Europe. So we will have a three-volume collected Francis Parker Yaki edition eventually. So that's an exciting thing. Charles Kraft is also working on... Yeah, Charles Kraft is also working on a Francis Parker Yaki memorial plate. So we'll unveil that as well. And it's going to be the inauguration of his Thought Criminals series. And I guess to close, I'd like to mention one of those thought criminals that he is going to be commemorating is Ernst Zundel, who just died this past weekend. And, you know, I want to give my condolences to his widow, Ingrid. I've also written to her privately, but just publicly, Ingrid, you know, you're in our thoughts. And we will have some kind of obituary for Ernst. Something is in the works right now. And when I get done with this recording, I'm going to actually contact the person and, you know, bang a stick on his cage or something to get the thing done. But yeah, so Ernst Zundel is no longer with us. I met Zundel on a couple of occasions, and I should write up a little memoir of him, too, while my memory is still with me. But anyway, so that is one sad note to end on. But that's the shop talk for this time. So, guys, do you want to add anything before we wrap up?
Well, nothing I can think of.
Yeah, you pretty much said everything.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being here, for listening in again. And we'll be back next week for another edition of Countercurrents Radio.
Thanks a lot. See you then.
See you guys next time.